Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, bringing together some of the best college soccer-related people to your earbuds, from coaches to players and beyond. So, thank you for tuning in. The Inside College Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer experts. Now, enjoy the show.
Hey, everybody, welcome to another edition of Inside College Soccer. You know, if you listen to us a lot, you know that we interview everybody, not just coaches. But for me, it's always a genuine pleasure when I can bring in a longtime coach to have a discussion with, because no matter what levels you've coached at, whether it's junior college or NAIA or D3 or D2 or D1 or even pro, coaches find things to bond over. And this is one of those coaches that we've talked before, but we've never spent any time with each other, but we always feel like we're connected in some way. And Chris, you reached out to me the other day and it reminded me, I need to ask you to come on the podcast. So today we've got Coach Chris Birch. How are you, Chris?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. No, you're so right. It's like this is the spider web and the connections through soccer world small.
Yeah, no, we have a staff member on that you actually coach, Danny Reynolds, right?
Oh, for sure. Danny's the man. He's great.
Yeah. You got any Danny stories for us that you'd like to tell out of school? Danny's a character. For those of you who don't know Danny Reynolds, he's one of these people in life that if you meet him, you will probably never forget him. He's just a character. And he's full of personality and life and energy. And you got to have at least one good Danny story for us, right?
Well, a clean one? No, I'm just kidding. Danny's about the salt of the earth. Just very lovely. I don't know if I have any stories, but just to talk about him, he's a good friend and a good person, and always has time to connect and wants the best out of people and helping people, and generally has a smile on his face all the time. And you know, if he doesn't have an answer, he'll go find it. And no, he's just a really good person. I've been proud to not only coach but stay in touch with.
Yeah, no, he's a good dude with a lot of experience. He's great to have around. So Chris, now you're one of these guys. In fact, I was just thinking about this the other day to myself. For no reason, and maybe you spurred this thought in me, that some of my best, most fun years that I really had were not as a head coach necessarily, although I enjoyed being a head coach for its own reasons, but being an assistant gave me freedom to get to know the players in a different way, and not having that responsibility of being that head coach, that some of my most enjoyable seasons were being an assistant. And you're, of course, a head coach now, but you spent most of your career as an assistant, didn't you?
For sure. I think the real cool thing about being an assistant is you can have different conversations with, you know, student athletes than maybe as a head coach. You know, you can kind of, when things are going well, you can talk to them a certain way. When things aren't going so well, you can be, you know, a set of ears. You know, as the head coach, you know, the difference is you sometimes have to make hard decisions and it falls on you. That I think if I could be an assistant somewhere else and have those great conversations with the student athletes and hang out in the locker room with them a little bit more, and I probably would. But obviously running your own program is special. But again, some of that comes with things that aren't so glorious as well.
Yeah, I know. It's so funny. It's always just be careful what you wish for, at least for me, Chris. I won't speak for you, but I really wanted to run my own program because I would see things that the other coaches did. And I thought I might do that differently, or I might handle that differently or something. And I wanted to see if I could do it. I did. And because I spent most of my career like you as an assistant, I did. I spent 12, 13, 13 of my 22 years were as an assistant. So the majority of them were as an assistant. And then when you get there, you realize, oh, all these problems that the head coach handled that I really never knew about, you know, that meeting with administrators primarily, and some of the paperwork and some of the meetings that they just leave us assistants out of. We don't need to know. And even some of the player, those hard decisions that had to be made, that you were kind of glad the head coach had to make those decisions and you didn't have to, because maybe you really liked that kid, right? Or you got along with them and you didn't want to see him have to leave the program for whatever reason. I didn't like those moments very much as a head coach. I almost felt like I got to coach more as an assistant than I did as a head coach. Did you kind of feel the same way?
I think, everything you were saying, I think is the same. Like, you're kind of like, I don't like to have this conversation, but sometimes you got to deliver the bad news if you want to hear good news here and there. So I agree with you. Like the administration, dealing with housing, doing fundraising, dealing with the budget, that's the stuff a lot of the times the head coach typically spends more energy on. You're kind of like, well, what do you do all day? Well, that's the stuff. Right. I think, as a head coach, obviously when I, took over the program, you have to prove that you can coach, and you got to get deep into the weeds and coach and prove that you know what you're doing. And then, obviously when you hire good assistants, you want to give them the freedom to keep growing and let them coach. And I think that's really important, because if I do all the coaching 99.9% of the time, they don't grow as coaches either. And that's not fair to them. So, I'm very lucky. I've had a really good staff in place for 2 years. It's turned over a little bit, but I've been able to really surround myself with awesome people first, and then obviously their intelligence in the game and their relationships and how they treat our student athletes.
If you look at it from a head coach perspective, and we talk about bringing on assistant coaches, what kind of things do you look for in an assistant coach? Obviously, most of them don't have much experience. You were an exception, and I was an exception to the rule, where we were older and more mature. We weren't just starting up, but most assistants start out younger, right? It's maybe their first coaching job, or maybe it's their first college coaching job. What kind of things do you look for in assistant coach when you're trying to bring them in to help your program?
Yeah, it's not a one size fits all, but I think it has to align with balancing me out as a person and a coach. If the person brings the same exact traits that I'm good at, and then the things that I'm not so good at, they're not good at, and they don't want to touch those subjects, that's not very good. Or you need to hire another assistant that balances out maybe some of the grunt work or some of the tedious work. I'm not one who likes to push things down the line all the way to the bottom and say, you deal with this. That's, if I can't do it myself, then I wouldn't give it to somebody else. But I think when you hire somebody, you're always looking for a good person. At the end of the day, we don't talk soccer. I just like being around you. That's like, as a human being, and culture is really big for everywhere I've been and how I do things. And so it always starts with hiring great people, and obviously want them to be knowledgeable and care and trustworthy, that they can go identify players. And, if they go on recruiting, they can handle their business properly on the road. Game days, can they coach in the moment? And yeah, I think it's hard to get keep an assistant for 30, 40 years. It just doesn't happen very often, unless it's a special place or the family's solidified in that area or the significant other has a great job or whatever. Usually people are always aspiring for more or to become a head coach at some point. So that's where if you really do treat people right, they tend to stay longer. If you don't treat them well, then you're going to constantly be looking for assistant coaches all the time.
Yeah, it's so hard. The general public has no idea, A, how little soccer coaches make compared to American football and basketball coaches. And you coach at some of the biggest schools in the country, UConn and Xavier, they're football or, basketball powerhouses, And we see what they make, and even their assistants, and even their second assistants and their third assistants. Soccer is just fighting to get one full-time assistant. And it's many of our assistant coaches, literally, if that's all they were to subside on was their soccer money, would be considered being paid at the poverty level.
Absolutely. I mean, I work for free at times, just because I wanted to be part of something. I then would work like 8-hour coaching gigs and, director of coaching, then doing my own private stuff on the side, getting, one school I was working at, I was like opening the doors to the gyms at like 5:30, 6 in the morning, then being a professor at that school on the side, then working at 8, 9, 10-hour day in the office, then doing youth soccer, then doing a clinic, and then getting home at like 12, 1 o'clock in the morning and sleeping for 4 hours for 4 or 5 months. It was not easy, but I didn't get into the sport and college soccer coaching for the money, obviously. And there are people who do get paid well, for sure, and those are few and far off. But I think most people get into the college world because they want the game at a higher level than maybe youth or high school or whatever it may be. And it's there's nothing like a game day on a college campus. It's tremendous. It's fun, and it's great to go on other college campuses. And obviously, when you win, that's sweet. And the road trips are great. I love road trips because I think it's I get to spend more time with my guys than like a home game. You see them in the locker room before the game, you coach them, and then after the locker in the locker room for 10-20 minutes, and that's it. On a road trip, you could be 2, 3, 4, or 5 days together, and that's quality time. So I think that's really why I really love being college soccer, and I've been in MLS and with Atlanta United, and that was wonderful too. But it was just, you missed those relationships with college athletes.
Yeah, but there's nothing like it. And we're going to circle back to that, but let's go back in time a little bit. How did this all start? Where did you grow up when you were, how did soccer come into your life, and where did the passion for the game begin?
Yeah. So it's kind of like a funny story. Like, I'm from a little small town called Clinton, New Jersey. It's in the sticks of Jersey, which people don't believe exists. I lived off a dirt road until I was a teenager. But soccer in New Jersey is obviously quite big. And, I started playing rec soccer at four. My brother hated it. He just didn't like it. He ended up being a runner. My dad was an Olympic qualifying runner. I was a runner who liked doing something besides just running. So I got to play soccer and played very competitively. Youth soccer was, you know, when ODP was pretty big back in the day. I was in the regional team. I got to the national pool. You know, I had a lot of college offers. And then, you know, the one time that's really important, kind of that junior, senior year, I got hurt for the first time in my life. And then some of those college opportunities, they saw me play and I tried to play through injury. I wasn't very good, to be fair. I was like, yeah, I wouldn't recruit me either. I can't perform my best. And so ended up going to a school, American University in Washington, D.C. We were good, quite good. I think we made the tournament two or three times, went to Sweet 16 and stuff like that. That was great. Good culture, good guys, great school, great area of D.C. And then, again, the only other time in my life I kind of got hurt was I was going to go try to play professionally. I had, like, I think, something lined up in Denmark. I got hurt. I tried to play through it. Again, couldn't get fit trying to play through an injury. So I got an opportunity to coach at UConn. And I was like, this is something you know, maybe I'll do for a short period while I rehab and get healthy again. And then I fell in love with coaching and I kind of just put my professional career aside. And I figured at the time, starting at such a great school with a great staff, it was something that, and my dad was a coach, track coach, cross country as well. So, like, he had the coaching genes. My parents always said I would be a great coach. Didn't kind of believe him. I kind of never really got one to get into coaching, to be honest. I thought I would always play forever. Right. You know, my mom's kind of like a mathematician. So I kind of like the side of, like, relationships and coaching, but, like, you got to find solutions. Like, that equation is, like, I always want to find solutions, and I don't identify right. The problems. I'm a problem solver. Right. And so I don't talk about what we don't have. I talk about what we do. And I'm definitely a blend of my parents and my genes and what they kind of were good at. And so when I got into coaching at UConn, it just kind of went from there, and it's been a blessing.
Yeah, right on. That's so you started at UConn and you stayed there for a good number of years as your career started, right?
I think one of the great things.
How'd that progress? Like, how'd you end up making decisions to move? How do you know when to move? How do opportunities come up? And it's just so good for young coaches to start out to hear, like, this is a real pathway that you've created for yourself.
Sure. Obviously, I was very young. I was like 23 years old or whatever it was. When I started, I was the bottom of a very talented coaching staff. Ray Reed was the head coach at the time, one of the most successful coaches in college soccer history. And UConn was one of the best in the country in everything. And I say, you know, Coach Reed cared about every single detail in the program. You know, after just even a few months there, I was like, this is like all college coaching? No, it's not. He just did things on a different level. Right. And so I stayed there for 4 years. And I can honestly tell you, Don, I felt ready to be almost a head coach after those few years, let alone being the top assistant at any school in the country. And so word got out there that I was like this hidden gem in the coaching world, you know? But it was fun because, like, everyone knows that those who worked under Coach Reed were very successful elsewhere because he is driven. He's hard. He's a hard man to work for at times, but he cares about success. And every single aspect of the program, like Coach Maroney, who's the legendary coach before Coach Reed at UConn, they're just so thorough and so detailed. And I'm a detailed person. So I love trying to get every single conceivable thing the best that I possibly can in this program. Right. And so I learned so much. And it was so fun because, like, as I got further into my 3-4 years there, I was getting opportunities to coach at some of the top schools in the country. And I was kind of like, well, I still feel like I'm learning. I'm still like I'm getting better. And then eventually there was an opportunity to go to Syracuse, which I believed was a sleeping giant. And clearly what it's turned into, you know, obviously is what I believed in. And then I just obviously moved on to a different program, stuff like that. But yeah, I think those experiences for young coaches is go where you're learning the most. If you're just comfortable and you're stuck or it's easy. I think that's where the growth stops. And then you try and associate yourself with people and you keep learning to network, and you never know when a rock turns over or you look in the bushes and then the doors are closed on you and what opens up in different ways. And so there's so many great things about networking that can open up doors down the road. And so I think it goes back to like what I said about my staff is you treat people the right way, you never know what door is going to open up for you maybe down the road.
Yeah, that's right. And you really have coached with some of the top coaches in the country. You coach with Lola and you've coached at the truly at what we would call the national championship level, right? Yeah. How is that different from coaching at the mid-major level, which I guess we would consider where you're at now, more of the mid-major level, right? How is there a difference, first of all, and how is the recruiting different? How is the coaching different? Do you approach anything differently?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's easy when you're a big brand name, you snap your fingers and everybody's interested, or I send an email or a text, and you get instant response. And when, you know, I was at Xavier, the program had never made the NCAA tournament in like 35 years. And when we were hired, the staff, they were just hoping that we'd make the conference tournament by like year two or three. First year, we made the tournament, and then we beat the number one, two, three seeded teams in the tournament, and we won and got the NCAA tournament. They were super happy, right? We did it again in year two. In year three, we were only like a half away from winning the Big East regular season when we switched to the Big East. And then in year four and five, we went to the second round and then went Sweet 16. So we went four out of my 5 years. And the 1 year we didn't, we were almost the Big East champions. And then I think it was like 10 years, Xavier didn't go to the tournament again. So we took like a low major to a mid major to a power player where we were ranked in the top. And so you do see as you build something, and I'm a builder, I truly like the transformational side versus the transactional side. And I will tell you that I've worked at places that have unbelievable facilities. Stadiums are some of the best in the country. And then you get a student athlete on campus and they just blown away by the gear and the stadium. And I'm like, that's great. But here's also what else we can offer to you. And, you know, and so I like at Lindenwood, for example, the place is unbelievable. So beautiful. But it's more transformational for me because we don't have this big brand name like a UCLA or a Duke or whatever, where every kid in the country is going to drop what they're doing and probably want to go there. We're different that like, you know, I've had 23 guys on campus in 2 years and all 23 have committed. That's how impressive this place is. So but wow. No one knows that. That's okay. I want people who want to be here for all the right reasons. Right. It's a special place with great people. We're growing this thing so fast. But I want the right people on the bus. And so it's such a different, you have to really build strong relationships with the student athletes. You're not just going to say, hey, we're Lindenwood. Everyone's going to drop what they're doing and come here, which is fine. I knew what I signed up for. This, the very first time I drove on campus and made the first turn, I go, whoa, look at this place. This is unbelievable. It's beautiful. And it's got X, Y, and Z. So I think, yeah, so it's, I think with the portal, and I'm sure we'll talk about that, but the portal is very much, you know, kids are always looking to play for the biggest brand names. And, you know, there's a lot of great programs out there for sure. We have to do our homework and we got to dig a little bit deeper, and it's okay. Which is why we're going to be very successful, because our foundational level is just getting better and better. And it's just a really awesome thing. So yeah, there is definitely a difference between a mid-major aspiring to be a major program, but it takes time. It takes a little bit more time.
Yeah, no, this whole idea of a transformational coach and transactional coach, I didn't realize how, of course, I think there can be a blend of the two. I think that it's not two ends of the spectrum that doesn't ever blend in the middle. But I didn't realize how much of a transactional coach I was until I read a book about transformational coaching and I really thought about it. And I thought, yeah, I really want to be more of a transformational coach. In other words, for those that are listening that don't understand what we're talking about, why don't you give us your version and your view of a transactional coach versus a transformational coach?
Sure. Yeah, a great story is, you know, when I took over, you know, the program emerged from Division II to Division I. So yes, everyone thinks that's great, but sometimes that's not what student athletes maybe signed up for. And so some guys weren't maybe as committed as they wanted, not knocking D2 by any means. It's just that the mentality is different. The work rate, the load, the demands, the fitness, it's just more, right? So I was able to bring in 21 guys my first recruiting class, which is a lot. And then I don't personally ever want to do that again. But the first like four or five guys I committed, basically committed sight unseen. They didn't know, even probably know where Lindenwood was. I hadn't brought them on campus. They committed for me. And they said kind of like, coach, if you ever become a head coach, I'm coming to the school you're at. And I had two guys that I previously coached. I had a guy who I recruited to try and get to a different school I was at and ended up not committing. I ended up going to a different school. We just stayed in touch and always just tried to give advice if I could. And then an opportunity came when I got this job and he was looking for a new school and he instantly goes, I'm coming. And so on and so on. So the reason I bring up those guys is I think, you know, the five guys that I either had coached, I had either committed and then never coached. There's a guys that I recruited and didn't coach, but the way I treated them from either coaching them personally or not coaching them or stayed in touch with them or I even helped them. I'm more impressed at the five guys. I'm more happy, I should say, about the five guys and the 16 others because I must have done something in their lives that said, hey, you did a good job treating me right. You did a good job coaching me. You cared about me. You're passionate. You always asked about my family. The other 16, they're wonderful and I love every one of them. The difference is they were recruited to Lindenwood and because what we're doing and how we're doing. They didn't know anything about me until they started that recruiting process. So I'm very, the transformational side is obviously I transformed their lives or I was a transformational influential person in their lives that they were willing to come to the school sight unseen. That's pretty powerful stuff. And it wasn't anything about like, hey, I can offer you this kind of package or this scholarships. There was guys who committed in those five guys that say, coach, I'm going to commit to you. We can figure out everything else later. The academics, the athletics, the scholarships. And I go, wow, that's committed. You don't know if you're paying $100,000 out of pocket or $0. But I right. thought that was really special because I had the right people that I obviously treated well in the past. And they were very caring and always felt like I was an important person in their life. And so that to me is what transformational leadership is.
Yeah, the book I was talking about, I don't know if you've read it, Inside Out Coaching.
Oh, is that the tennis?
Joe Ehrman.
Oh, yeah, in the football, yeah, football guy.
Yeah, American football. And I read that thing. It's like, oh, yeah, I want to be like that. That's the difference I want to make. And I try to tell people this online, you know, through my platforms, that if you can find a coach who really wants to make a difference in your life and will stick with you thick and thin, you're going to grow so much more than if it's, well, I'll keep you if you can score 12 goals for me this year. But if you don't score any, then I'm going to have to let you go. That transactional relationship, not that we can't get where we're going out of that. I mean, that can be a motivator and it can be a driver to make you want to perform as a player. But when you've got somebody who really cares about you as a person and wants to make a difference in your life and will stick with you no matter what. Look, when we recruited kids, it was hard to get kicked out of the program. I mean, you had to be willfully disobedient over and over and over for us to tell you to go away because we felt like we owed it to you because we brought you in to stick with you. And even if you're the last player to come off of our bench, it doesn't mean that you mean less to us than our leading goal scorer. You're going to be treated the same. You're going to be given the same opportunities. And our office is open to you just as much as it's open to that leading goal scorer. You're all part of our family. And I am noticing, it feels to me, and I'll say it's all anecdotal, and we don't want to paint a broad brush over everything, Chris, but it feels to me like players are becoming more transactional and coaches are becoming more transactional. That the idea of, coach, I owe you my debt of gratitude for bringing me into your program and giving you opportunity, and I'm proud of our school, and I want to graduate from this school, and this is our family, and also coaches bringing in players and with the attitude of, no, you're not going anywhere from our perspective. We brought you in and we owe you your 4 years and we're just as grateful to you for committing to us. That loyalty is slowly subsiding with the, not just in only the transfer portal, but with NIL money. There's a Power Four coach, I won't name the school and the coach, but he said that the first question that these girls were asking now is, will you guarantee me playing time and how much money will you give me? First questions in an interview. And I was blown away by that, because when I retired in 2018, that hadn't kicked in yet. And I couldn't believe that players would have that audacity. I would never do that in a job interview, by the way. How much vacation are you going to give me in my first job interview? When's my first raise? And can you guarantee me that I won't be fired in the next 10 years? I would never dream of doing that. Are you noticing the same thing? Of course, you're on the men's side, and I think of the men's and the women's side, and having coached on both. But are you noticing a shift in mores and attitudes in societally within the world of soccer?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm a big fan of loyalty, and part of that transformational side is, like, I think it's not just a 4-year relationship, it's a 40-year. I want to know what you're doing 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 years from now with where do you live? Do you have kids? How's your family? That kind of stuff. And so you lose that with, like, you just look at professional sports, for example, a trickle-down effect. Like, how many times do you see a baseball player like Cal Ripken or Jeter or any of these guys stay for 20 years with their club, with their organization? It doesn't happen anymore. And so now we've opened up different pathways to transfer more. We've given the power back to the player. And so you are seeing that, like, first chance to jump, can I and should I and will I? And the grass is not always greener elsewhere. But the opportunity financially may be, or, hey, I scored 8 goals. I got to take this and run with it. Okay, well, then maybe go somewhere else and you score 2 goals. Is that good for your career? You said you want to be a pro. I don't know how many clubs, professional clubs, want to sign a forward who scores 2 goals in 20 games. I don't think that's right. Equation. And so I think the rules have changed to create this lack of loyalty. I'm not faulting the student athletes. I think there's opportunities. And you see it happens, obviously, clearly in the power sports of football and basketball, where a guy throws for 20 touchdowns and rushes for how many yards, and all of a sudden that is financial game-changing money. You almost have to leave because the money's so good somewhere else, right? And so I kind of running joke is, like, you've seen hearing about some of these athletes making like $1 million, $2 million or whatever, and I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna say I'm hurt this year. I'm gonna take a redshirt year. I'm gonna stay another year, get that extra $1 million, and then just keep redshirting and medical redshirting. I'm staying in college for 6-7 years, racking up $6-7 million, and then you go to your professional world and you don't make that kind of money. So you might as well rack up that money while you can, if you're getting it, you know? So it's can't fault the player again, or hate the game. It's just, that's the way it's changed. And so it's been difficult because it's a trickle down effect. Isn't as great in, you know, lesser sports, Olympic sports of tennis and soccer and volleyball and baseball. It's out there. There's big NIL money out there, but when there is, it's usually a special occasion, or, you know, a donor or boosters. Now you're starting to see boosters are running athletic departments, which is crazy that you're seeing no loyalty. You're seeing, I think could be wrong. I thought it was a basketball player just committed, the number one recruit in the country just committed to BYU. They're not known as a powerhouse, but they had the most NIL money. So he's taking it, running with it, you know? So you're just seeing how the game has shifted.
Yeah. And I'm with you, man. Look, in basketball and football, I do believe that athletes were being exploited while the NCAA, the schools, and even the coaches made millions and millions, and they were using these athletes for free. It's so hard to explain to people that's not soccer for the most part. And maybe it is 0.1% of all of the players that at the very top, in other words, the top 20 players in the country, maybe 3 of them or 4 of them. And people want to talk about, like, all soccer players, right? And it's like, you don't understand. It's such a minuscule percentage of soccer players. I think there's probably more NIL money on the women's side than there is on the men's side, for Pete's sake. I mean, I know Texas signed at least 2 players that I know of for over $100,000. These are unproven freshmen. And that's big money. And I think that's cool. Whereas, you know, schools like Indiana seem to be using most of their NIL money to make sure that everybody can have a full ride, right? Which I think is an admirable way of looking at it too. It's being looked at differently. But I think my point is, Chris, is it's not track and it's not rowing and it's not golf. It's not soccer. It's, you know, these rule changes have been driven by American football and primarily men's basketball as these drivers. And the rest of us, I feel, are hanging on for dear life and just getting drugged through the water. Like, if I'm water skiing and I fall down and I'm not going to let go, and it's like, well, we can't let go, but this is painful for soccer to go through this. And then of course, the public, and this is one of the reasons why I love doing these podcasts. I'm hoping people will listen and hear and become educated, but we shouldn't be looking at soccer as a way to become a millionaire in the college game, because I'm not sure that it will ever happen. And if it does, I'll be long dead before it does happen. And you may be gone too before it happens, because we're talking about maybe the fourth or fifth sport, depending on the stats you look at, of as far as viewership and money spent in the United States is soccer. We might be behind hockey, for Pete's sake. And our soccer community is just looking at this all wrong. If we think that, you know, I, like you said, I play at the 10 and I scored 4 goals this year. Coach wants to have me back, but I'm going to transfer in hopes of going to UConn or Indiana or Notre Dame or Stanford or whatever the bigger name might be. And those schools don't need average. They don't need more average. They need something better than they have. And by the way, that kid's that's better than they have played for Manchester United's youth team all the way up till 19 years old and is way more experienced than the American kid. How do you look at that? One of the complaints we get, Chris, all the time, it's from the parent of the average. And when I say average, I mean ability-wise, the average American kid out of high school that's thoroughly pissed off that Marshall is basically starting all Americans, you know, I mean, all internationals, right? And they're pissed off because they're saying, that's my kid's spot that kid's taking. That's my tax dollars that are paying for that public school that are helping fund scholarships for an international kid. And it's not fair to the American player. And they're taking spots away from my kid. What do you think about that?
Yeah, is it not fair that my school rewards academics really well? I mean, like we package really well through academics. Should we be faulted? Another school, in Florida, all the Florida schools have the Caribbean scholarship and they have all this other funny stuff. Every school's got a quirk. You got to use it. And, you know, it's why certain coaches take certain jobs and other ones is not a great job. It might be a big brand name. Like, whoa, that'd be great to coach there. Oh, actually, it's $75,000 with no academic money. That's hard to package. And I think schools that are creative, they find ways to make the packaging better. So sometimes it is, I heard someone told me at a different school that they have like 32 countries around the world that they in-state scholarship with. You're like, that's like funny money, right? And so they got it, use it. And that's how you're going to get more international. Other schools I've worked at actually did not cater to international students and made it very difficult. So you went a lot more Americans. And so who am I to say how anybody does anything? I think we're all trying to build a team that's competitive, compete to win, and to each its own. I think one thing that the rules have changed is the portal has helped teams get older, which hurts the younger American kids. And it's like, and like you said, that loyalty is a little bit lost, but it's like, what can you do for me now? You didn't last semester, you were poor. I'm going to go find someone better than you. And it's just kicked to the curb. Or you had a good semester. I'm going to leave and look elsewhere. That's where that transactional side, you're seeing some great, great coaches like the Virginia basketball coach, you're seeing Saban, you're seeing Villanova basketball coach. They're all leaving partially because they don't like the direction college athletics has gone to. And so it's funny to see Belichick come in and try to deal with some of this stuff. He's probably gonna have all his assistants. No, you deal with it.
Right.
So I think, you know, like last year in 2023, I started 7-8 freshmen, which means they had to have been probably 18 to 19 tops. One guy was 17. And yet we're going against everyone else whose average age is 24, 25 years old. It is a huge difference to compete with a bunch of 17 to 20 year olds than versus 20 and above. And so Marshall is old, and that's why they're very talented. They're well coached. They're good, but that's how he chooses to run it. I mean, it's what he's able to do. And I think that's difficult because there's so many good American players and we're only developing better and better, but there's going to be less opportunities because with the roster capping at 28 or less, not everyone's going to have 28 spots. It's the trickle down effect's going to be real. And I know you've tried to communicate this numerous different ways to people is the biggest benefactors will be the trickle down effect of like mid majors in Division I, top Division IIs, NAIAs, junior colleges. Like I would tell anybody, if someone wants you, take it, seize it, take your opportunity, do something with it. And then you can springboard different, open different doors for yourself that you never would have had 6 months ago. And it's just hard because nobody wants to hear that. Nobody wants to start not at their dream school. that is going to become the reality for most kids, not less kids. More than not, it's going to be, you're going to start somewhere else and end up where you want to go in the end.
Yeah, I called it the other day I called it trickle-down recruitonomics.
Yeah.
And I had a conversation yesterday with a buddy of mine who's a national championship level NAIA school, right? And he said, we just grabbed two kids that 2 years ago, we could not have gotten. They would have gone to a big Division I school, but there's no room at that level. And so they come here for the opportunity to play right away. And I could give them the money that wasn't going to be available to them, or the roster spot that wasn't going to be available to them. And he said, we got a lot better. And, you know, my son coaches in junior college at a nationally ranked junior college program in Idaho. And he's saying the same thing. And I'm seeing some of the kids that he's getting. And I'm going, this kid, 5 years ago, you wouldn't have stood a prayer at getting this kid. And now this kid that you've got is unbelievable. And yeah, I think you're right, Chris. And I think that's a healthy way to look at it, is take the best opportunity that's available to you at the time, and then just see where your career takes you. And I call it betting on yourself, right? Gambling on yourself, believing in yourself enough that you don't need to make unrealistic demands of coaches. You can just go prove it, right? Players need to play to prove themselves, right?
And the other side of the coin too is, you know, there are players who are very talented and go to some of the best programs in the country, and then they don't play. And they either go 1 year without playing. Okay, that's not a death sentence, but then you stick around a second year and you don't play, or you play very marginally. Then you hit the portal and you're like, well, I played at X, Y, and Z schools. They're very good. We're very good. But most teams don't want to pick up players who haven't played somewhere else or haven't played much in the last year or two. They're looking to find guys who played 15 games at center back, whether it's Division II, NAI, and junior college. Like, my roster is very well balanced. I got true freshmen. I have redshirt freshmen. I have transfers that came from NAI, junior college, Division II, and Division I. I have everything, right? And some of my best players come from the smallest brand name schools out there. And so I love that, because they come here hungry to prove, and they're aspiring to play Division I versus, I played at this other bigger name school, I'll just transfer to another Division I. It's fine. Want the student athlete who's driven by opportunity. And then if you only get 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, you want to make the most of that time. So, I think it is so important to find somewhere you can go and be successful, because if you go even to a better school and you don't play, it actually could be the end of your career at 17, 18, 19 years old, because you're going to hit the transfer portal and just sit there and then not go anywhere.
Yeah. And exactly. No, it's so true. And I'd advised I won't name the school. You and I know this coach very well, and they've won on the men's side multiple national championships. There was a kid that was playing minutes since his freshman year. They've traveled him every year, and they would have kept him going into his junior year on the roster. But the kid walked in and said, I want to play this next year. And the coach says, then you probably should transfer, because I can't guarantee that, if that's what you wanted to guarantee. And the backstory is, and they always tell people, find out your why. What is your why? The kid's ultimate goal is to play professionally. And he's with a program that's produced maybe more professionals than any other team in the country, pretty close, at least as many. And so you make it into an environment. You have a staff that's willing to coach you, willing to train you, willing to help you move on. And are you going to become the next Ryan Saylor of the world? I often say, I want to interview Ryan. I need to get a hold of somebody who knows him, because I think Ryan Saylor might be the last Ryan and Saylor in the history of men's soccer. And for those of you that don't know, Ryan Saylor played a grand total of 30 minutes going into his senior year. Then at the end of his senior year, he's on the Herman Mack watch list. And then he gets drafted into the MLS to enter Miami, and, you know, he's living the pro life. But had Ryan Saylor bolted his freshman year or sophomore year or junior year, he may not have become Ryan Saylor. He may never have made it. And looking at your why long-term, I think it's really important. And for those out there that are listening, if your kid, all your kid cares, if your kid's my kid, all he cared about was soccer. From the time he was 10 years old on, he didn't care about anything but soccer. I guess there's no surprise that that's all he's ever had for a real job was coaching soccer. And that's all he does, as opposed to a kid that all they want to do is send rockets into space. all they've ever done is play with rockets, look at rockets, watch rockets on TV. They want to be an engineer. They want to be an aerospace engineer. That's what they want. But they're a soccer player, right? And they want, and they're a competitive soccer player, and they want to play. Those are two different whys. And then the choices that you make to lead you to your end goal are going to be different choices for the kid who all they do is care about soccer versus the kid all they care about is rocket science, right? And knowing that why for everybody out there is just so important, Chris. What do you advise kids as they're making decisions? Let's say you're recruiting kids and you meet all these kids for different, they have different whys. How do you walk them through that process?
Yeah, I think that's the key is what motivates you. Like I always ask the question, and it's not a requirement by any way, but every school I've been at, I've asked you, are your aspirations to be a professional soccer player? You can say no, and it's totally fine. I would still recruit you. For me, it's how I coach you is different, right? And so if you tell me you want to be a pro and you want to be your forward and you're only scoring one goal a season, two goals, five goals, it's not going to be enough. You have to work on your game and create, either get your shot off more, work on your finishing, your technique, or
right,
whatever that may be. But if you don't want to be a pro and you're scoring one or two goals and you're a senior, you're probably not going to grab a bag of balls outside of training and work on your game, because at the end of the day, your career's done at the end of the season. So what motivates you? What's your why? And so I know a guy is trying to be, own his own business, and that's all he cares about. I'm not going to drive and yell at him because he's not going to respond to that. So that for me, right, the intrinsic motivation is really critical in the recruiting process. And those goals, I re-ask again every year because your goals change. Because some guys we get, come in, think they're going to score 25 goals and they score four. And I'm like, yeah, it's harder than you think. I was going to tell you that. But also you maybe come in, you do score 15 goals and you didn't think you were going to score five. And now you're really good. And now, wow, man, maybe there are pro opportunities for you. So to your point about, Ryan, I know Ryan quite well because I was at SLU at the time and we were undefeated all the way into the Elite Eight and we lost to Washington on their mud field. But I was happy for him personally because I liked his story. But that's the same thing in reverse as well. Is a lot of guys go and have first year, second year, third year success, and they go, you know what, my last year, I'm going to go to this elite school to try and I have to play in this conference and this is the only way I'm going to be a pro. And then they don't start, they don't play in the next, they don't score goals or whatever. And then I always say you want to leave when your stock's high. You don't want to leave when your stock's low. So if you
good go advice.
Yeah, and if you go somewhere and you don't score a bunch of goals, even though it's a good program and you're a good player on a good program, but you didn't put up numbers, they're going to look at what have you done recently. Versus maybe you go to me and you score 20 goals. Guess what? Who doesn't need a 20-goal goal scorer, right? And so you always want to leave with your stock being, are you an all-conference player? Are you a leading goal scorer? Are you a shutout, tops and shutouts, whatever it may be. So what have you done for me lately? We talked about with the transfer portal is also the same thing with professional teams. They're not going to go look at your freshman year and sophomore year goals. They're going to look at your goals from your junior year, your senior year to play. They're going to go back and watch 90-minute games from your senior year. They're not going to go watch freshman year games. And no matter what you did then, no matter where you were, no one has that kind of time to go watch 74 games and go back to the 74th game your freshman year. So you really have to find that balance of your why and say like, hey, if I'm in it to win it and I'm in it to be a pro, or this is what I'm trying to do, stick with it, believe in yourself, but you also can believe yourself different ways. It's sometimes you might need to move laterally to move back up.
Yeah. And this idea, Chris, that that your college career is how you're going to make it professionally is so crazy ridiculous when you're going to graduate at most kids 20, 21, 22 years old, maybe 23. And then to think that this is it, because I didn't make it now, I'm never going to make it. And when we talk about professionally, by the way, if we're talking about the United States, I need our audience to understand that probably 90% of the guys under some kind of a pro contract also have a side job. In other words, what's the old country Western song? Semi-pro means semi-paid. Right? I mean, most of the professional soccer, even around the world, most of, unless you're in the Premier League or in the championship in England, you also drive a cab part-time, you also lay bricks part-time. You also do something else part-time because the soccer pay itself can't pay for your rent and your food and your personal expenses. And you got to have a little something towards retirement that you're putting aside. And the soccer can't do all that on its own. So, I know a lot of USL championship players that are on their contract is you get an apartment, which means they share it with four or five guys. And, you know, you're getting $1,000 a month. That's what you get. And that's not, you know, you still, in other words, you still, it's hard. A, doesn't mean you're going to make it. B, but also doesn't mean that the career's over. It means there's a pathway. And if I go in to a USL one team or a championship team, and I'm the leading goal scorer in the conference, the next level, whatever that is going to be interested in at least bringing me in on trial, which is all we can ever ask for, right? Is a trial, an opportunity to test, to be tested and to prove that we belong. That's all we can, that's all we deserve. If we've worked our butt off and we've, and that's all we're going to get is that opportunity. So I just want people out there to understand, Chris, because you coach at the professional level. What's the difference? I just asked this of Ian Foyer that I was just talking to. And I did a podcast with him a few minutes ago. What are the differences that you've noticed in maybe the mentality or the type of players between the collegiate guys that's their terminus is going to be their collegiate career versus the pro caliber player who we can tell are probably going to make it pro? Is there a difference that you've noticed?
Oh, absolutely. One of the first things that I've worked with, I think, close to 85 guys who've signed professional contracts. And then probably the number one thing they say is, wow, I have to change my diet. You get away with eating what you want in college. Wow. I gotta change my fitness habits. Yes, you told me I needed to get fitter. No, I'm working on it, getting up before practice and working their diet and their fitness. And then they just take better care of themselves. I like to use the example with the guys that if, you know, we have aspiring seniors who are trying to make it professional, and I go, you don't buy a mansion filled with IKEA furniture. You don't, you know, buy a Porsche and put water in the gas tank. You have right. to do your body and your mind and your sleep like it's the most important asset you have, because it is. And so what you get away with in college, yes, maybe you're the best player on my team, but would you be the best player on Clemson? Would you be the best player at UCLA? Probably not. So there's players better than you. I always had a mentality right. growing up is be the hardest worker on any team ever. That's what I control. I can't control being the best soccer player, but I can control my attitude, how hard I work, and my mindset and my fitness and my diet and everything. That's a controllable thing. So I think you start to see once those who make it in the professional world, it's their mentality, it's their diet, it's their fitness changes instantly. And they realize, shoot, I should have worked on this 3 months ago, 6 months ago. And the ones, you know, I'm most proud of, there's a lot of guys I've recruited. I was like, this guy will be a pro. I know it, regardless of how he eats and how his fitness is, he's just super special. I'm most proud of the guys who don't think they will be a pro, but they're like, hey, if it happens and it presents itself, great. But then over time, they just do everything right. Or they listen, they take notes, they change their diet, right. they work on their game. And I am most proud of when I turn on the TV is seeing those guys living out their dreams, because they aspire. They found their why was always in front of them, but also
right.
they have a plan. Nothing in life that if you want to be successful, if it's easy to do, everybody would do it, right? And so
right.
it's really important if you create these lofty goals, like I would love to go play in the Premier League, but if it doesn't, I'll go play in MLS. Well, every kid says that when I recruit them. I want to go play overseas. You know how hard it is to play in America, let alone overseas. I'm not going to squash those dreams by any means. But at the same time, let's start by getting you right. Your habits don't match a professional. Okay, let's fix those habits.
Right.
Say, yes, maybe your weak foot's not as good. Okay, we don't have that. It doesn't have to turn into gold, but it just can't be a weakness anymore. So we work on you before we think about whatever level you can play at. If you told me you want to get paid $2 a game, well, I could probably find that for you right now. If you say, yeah, I want to go make a career and make $1 million, well, then you got to get to work now. And it's going to take 4, 5, 6, maybe never, but we got to start now. So I do also ask what level you're trying to play at, so that I also know, hey, I just want to be in the USL or USL, you know, championship. Okay, well, that's doable. That's very doable. Okay, but MLS, it's gotten so hard to crack the MLS lineups because they now scout and recruit the whole world. Analytics is amazing. Data is amazing. Scouting and recruiting is amazing. Like the league is, I always laugh every 5 years. If you look back at where the league was and where it is now, you're kind of like, oh my God, the league was a joke back X, Y, Z. It's amazing.
Very true.
There's so many talented players. The facilities are incredible. The stadiums are incredible. The training facilities are incredible. It's wonderful. I don't think Americans give the league enough credit, because obviously there are better leagues in the EPL and whatnot, but it's pretty awesome what we're doing here in America.
And it has gotten better. I mean, we were season ticket holders with the San Jose Clash, by the way, and when it just started, and it was awful. I think I saw better college games than we saw in most of our games. And then you're right. Every 5-6 years, every new generation of players that's coming out, it seems to make everything, it is getting better. I mean, I think we got a long way to go, but it is getting better. It is improving. There is more interest generally from the public, and we're getting somewhere with the game. And I think that trickles down to college. I think people that said that we, you know, college was only lump and run soccer might have been right 10, 12 years ago. But we see some of these teams, we see how Akron plays and we see how Syracuse plays and you know, how some of these the teams that we can see in the tournament, how they're playing, and it's improving. Would you agree?
Oh, for sure. And you still see, and look, people always want to poo-poo college soccer. Look, it's not La Liga by any means, but what it does for you is it provides, maybe you're not ready at 17, 18 years old, but you need a few more years, but also college game, it's very difficult. It's physical. It's aggressive. It's a lot of games in a short period of time. It's mentality as much as it is fatigue and dealing with that and your mental state. And so you still see guys on the national team that have played college soccer. I coached one, Patrick Schultz, who's been second, third string goalie, star. I think he got two caps in 2024. He's only 23, 24 years old. Right. But he was in college for 3 years, right? There's Jordan Morris spent 3-4 years at Stanford. Tim Ream, who's had a long, lengthy career, he played at St. Louis. And so there are still players that are late bloomers. I think Americans tend to be late bloomers because we do focus a lot on the athleticism, too much, personally. The coaching is getting better at the youth levels, but what you don't know, you don't know. It takes longer to get. Or some guys just they're peanuts when you get them as a freshman. All of a sudden, as a senior, you're built Mack truck, right? The physicality of a man, it's just different. Maybe people grow a little faster and they're thrown into professional worlds over in England and wherever else earlier, but Americans are late bloomers. We coddle our kids and everything's got to be perfect grass fields and whatnot. Like they don't play in the streets and stuff as much as Brazil and whatnot, you know?
No, that's true. You mentioned something there about the physical side of the game. And I hear this complaint a lot about the American coaching and that the coaches only care about the physical players. And I look at this from my perspective, Chris, and that, anytime that I find myself going to the physical side of the player, it's because they didn't have the technical and the tactical ability. So what am I supposed to do with that? I get a kid in college that's 18 years old that can't even juggle the ball down to the end of the pitch and back. It doesn't have good first touch, doesn't have good ball control. And yet I have to rely on this kid to play. What style am I supposed to play? Am I going to play short out of the back to a bunch of backs who will lose the ball 60% of the time? I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go to a more direct style because I need the ball away from our goal. Because if we're trying to possess it in front of our goal, we'll be down 3-0 by halftime and we'll stand no chance of winning. And then I've had other teams, though, that are highly technical, right? I've had my most successful teams, unfortunately, for American parents aren't going to want to hear it, but have been full of internationals that had good youth international experience for teams like Ipswich and, you know, Newcastle at the youth level. They had a good technical foundation, a good tactical foundation, and we could play an attractive brand of football. So as coaches, the public needs to understand that we're coaching with what we have, you understand? And if I'm not the big brand name, if I'm not the Syracuse or the UConn or the Stanford or the Akron that can attract the best athletes in the world, the better ones, the better players are probably going to not choose me. They're probably going to choose them. And so I'm going to coach with what I have. How have you had to adapt your coaching style from being with the most well-known schools in the country now to being at a Lindenwood, right? How have you had to change your coaching style?
Oh, that's a great question. I'll run through real quick. I went from UConn to Syracuse to Xavier, to Louisville. Then I left to go to Atlanta United. And then I came back and coached at St. Louis University before Lindenwood. So there's the pathway. Yeah, every league is different. I was in the Big East. I was in the A-10. I was in the ACC, in the OVC now. And so, you know, when I was coaching at Louisville in the ACC, I'm like, wow, I really like this player. I like this player, this player. It's not going to work. He's technical, but a step slow. I need to go get the athlete, you know? And it was like, it became such a vertical style league. Very talented, but it was very athleticism heavy. You know, when I was in the Big East, you're recruiting more X's and O's, technical, smart players, a balance of that. And then the A-10 was a little bit more rugged. It was more vertical. It was more physical. but very difficult games. And so like every conference you're in, you have to recruit a different style of player. You see teams that you're like, this team's by far the best team in the conference, but they ain't going to win it because they have all technical players with no grit and no, you know, fighting spirit. Right. Everyone's entitled to build a team however they want. I think, you know, usually a league takes on a personality, and then whoever the top of the table is kind of who you're trying to build That's your right. team to beat them, or otherwise you'll always be below them. So I think, you know, college soccer is not, you know, like I said, La Liga here. So you can't just have all beautiful style players unless you get all elite. You know, I was at the junior college championships and there were so many nice players. I like them. Like, I like this guy, I like this guy, I like this guy. But I'm like, I need to get a lot of them to make them work together. Otherwise, I can't, you know, you can't have, you know, one of our running jokes in a program is I have good banter with my guys. And they asked me like, hey, coach, would we win a national championship if we had Messi? And I flat out said it 1 second later, no. They're like, you're wrong. I go, absolutely not. I go, we don't have the players around him. His eye for the game, he's going to see a run 15 seconds before you're willing to make it. I go, you have to have right. bring out his gifts. You know what I mean? Right. You know, and so you have to build teams that are based on the league and what your success and like, what is my end goal with each program I'm at? Is it just to be competitive? Is it to try and win the league? Is it to try and make a deep run in the tournament? Is it to make one push now and then rebuild it, or to be consistently good every year? If I'm going to be consistently good every year, then I find consistent players. If I want, hey, I have this forward and this winger that want to come here and they're super, super special. But if I get them and they graduate next year, well, then I'm going to probably take a dip the next year. I can't replace special with average, right? And so I think every year is different. Every team's different. I think for me, I just always try and get the right, best people, but always that I believe are coachable and are bought into what we're trying to do as a team. We play a lot of different ways. For me, the players decide. We have a lot of principles that we follow, but it's always the tactics are always based on the people and whether we trust right. on the field. And so I usually play players that I trust, and then we'll switch the tactics around the best players we have.
Was that I? You may have seen me post this one multiple times. Coaches play the players they trust on and off the pitch.
It's a hot.
What does that mean to you?
Well, first, I always equate good academics with more consistency on the field. So if there's young men and women out there listening, your academics will open up more doors than soccer will. You will see your teammates that are recruited. You're like, how did that person go to so-and-so school? Probably because their academics gave them a huge package. And now that you became more recruitable or unrecruitable. Right. I am a huge fan of high academics. I believe in it personally, but I also think those who are willing to sacrifice all those extra hours to study and look, I didn't like science classes and stuff like that, but you know what? It was important to me to get good grades. So I grind, I spend more time studying in those classes. If I'm willing to do that on stuff that I don't really like as much, guess what that person's willing to do at soccer, which is the fun thing in their lives. They're willing to give everything they have, right? So the ones, I see these teams that go up and down every other year and they have special players. I'm like, I bet those guys are erratic in the classroom. And so for me, academic consistency is important to athletic consistency. And I think those teams that tend to have good academics, you know, you're not seeing Stanford be poor very often. You know, those guys are good student athletes and they're a good program and well coached. So I'm a big fan of that. I think the consistency comes from those who are studious tend to obviously do better and more consistent on the field. I do think the reverse is true too. Those who are inconsistent in the classroom tend to be inconsistent in their soccer. Like when it's cold out, the referee's bad and field stinks, they tend to go up and down with their play. But guys who tend to have it, could be wrong, it's my own equation, it's my belief, but I look for guys who are very studious in the classroom because I think that makes a more consistent player.
Yeah, and you may not be able to comment on this being in your position, but it also comes to the personal lifestyle and how these kids handle being away from home. I don't know that I've ever met a freshman who didn't go off their rocker at some point their freshman year, you know, with, holy crud, my parents aren't here. If I drink alcohol, it's nobody's going to know. If I'm smoking weed, nobody's going to know. Nobody's here to monitor me. And, you know, while some freshmen can make it through that virtually unscathed, many can't. They just and their food, right? We talked about the nutrition, what they're eating. You know, maybe at home parents kind of wouldn't buy the things that they, you know, the Pop-Tarts or the Cheetos or the, I don't know, the whatever, the junk food, we'll just say. And now they're on their own. Nobody's looking over their shoulder. Nobody's telling them what time to go to bed. Nobody's telling them time to put the phone away and go to sleep. And freshmen and sometime even in the sophomore year, kids just can't get over that. I'm responsible for me and I need to take care of me. So I mean, for me, it's not just the grades and it's not just the classes, but it's that overall lifestyle. And we used to call it living the athletic lifestyle. Like, what would Messi do? How would he eat? What would he do? Even if you don't know, pretend you're him. What would you do with all of these things at your resources? You're trying to see how many years are in a row that you can be the top player in the world. Can I do it 2 years in a row? Can I do it 3 years in a row? Can I do it again? Can I win two national titles? Can I win three? Can I win four World Cups? What can I do? And then live that lifestyle, right? So what's your advice to freshmen coming in about this newfound freedom that most of them are going to have and then how to manage it?
Yeah, it's. I think the freshman first semester is the most fun semester you'll have in college, in the sense where, like, everything, you're away from home for the first time, you're able to stay out late, it's everything. It's forming new relationships, it's meeting significant others, it's fun, right? And so, but the dangers of that are, you know, unless you get there in the spring for the fall semester, you can get kind of some of that stuff out of the way of, like, learning and making mistakes and staying up too late and forgetting to, oh, I got to study for this test. And now I'm
so jealous of baseball coaches, Chris. I was always so jealous that they could get that first semester out of the way without having to cut kids or say, you're not going to play today. But soccer, we start practice before school even starts.
Right. And that's the danger is, you know, time management is off. When we first start soccer in preseason, they just think you're here like a pro team. There's nothing else but soccer to talk about and do. And so they go back to the dorms, they play video games, they hang out, they go, when's meal? Okay, I'll go recover. Okay, I'll get soccer again. It's not reality. Once school hits, wham, it hits you. And then again, school isn't difficult when it first starts. There's no tests and quiz typically in the first week or so. Right. And all of a sudden you get to that third week, fourth week or midterms, and all of a sudden, wham, it hits you like a ton of bricks, and you see a lot of inconsistencies in individuals and you see inconsistencies in teams. And some academic schools that I've worked at, you try to not schedule too much around that outside of conference, which you're kind of forced to, but you start to see up and down and play. And you're like, you see around the country, you know, in college soccer, anybody can beat anybody, but you're like, wow, I didn't see that team beating that team. It's like, well, don't forget, it's a very academic school and there's, you know, they're crushing the academics. They're probably not sleeping very well. And it's hard. That first semester is really hard. So I think, if you have the opportunity, and this usually starts earlier in your high school career, it's very difficult. Get ahead of it. Get those, you know, some college credits done. Take some summer classes so that maybe you can get in a semester early. And that gives you two things. It gives you a buffer of saying, hey, I'm going to try and come out after my fall of my senior year. I'm going to start at a spring my senior year at a school. That, gosh, it's anyone who comes in a spring semester early is night and day different than coming in. And like you said, we play a game 3 days, 4 days after starting preseason, you know, an exhibition. But what you know, and also as you're a junior or a senior in college, is you laugh at what you thought you knew as a freshman. You're naive and green freshman compared to what you know, like, as a junior and senior. And so I think my little bit of like a quick rundown of the advice would be, obviously, can you get there early? If you can't, can you get to campus early and train with the seniors or the captains? Can you get to meet those guys? Can you figure out all that stuff early? Ask them what works. Ask them what doesn't work. Find those who played college soccer. Ask them questions. What's the three most important things for you, or five most important things? And then really work on, you know, changing your diet, changing your habits. What are the fitness tests? Give it to me way in advance so I can practice these things. Because a lot of these guys, we give them fitness tests, they're doing it for the first time and they fail it because they don't know how to prepare their breath, their mind, their rest, their recovery. They go out and run it too fast, too early. That type of stuff sets you back. Then you get injured, and you get injured in preseason. It's semi a death sentence, depending on how long you're out, because once the team is solidified, coaches don't like to make major changes unless it's needed. And usually it's needed when you're not winning. When you're winning, you don't change much, right? So all those things add up. And college season with an ankle injury can wipe out six games in 3 weeks. You know, it's your season's gone. And then your happiness isn't there. And you lose your spot. And then, hey, we found someone who stepped up. We didn't think was going to step up. He's going to be my starter next year. And so trying to always be a little bit scared you're not good enough, and do more and prepare more and start your fitness. We always tell our guys, like, you're pounding the fitness late July and early August, you're not fit. And you're compounding the load into another load. There's no preparation for preseason other than going through preseason. It's so difficult at every school in the country because the load is insane, but we don't have a huge runway to get all the work in that we need. And other than, like, football and stuff, they do no pads. They do just, you know, walkthroughs. Volleyball's in a air conditioned gym. We're out in 95 degree heat. You're dehydrated. You're exhausted. So college soccer is very archaic in some ways that we haven't really evolved the beautifulness of the game to what the science tells us. But you got to get ahead. You got to ask questions. You got to do more. Ask questions of the coaches that you're going to play for. Like, what can I do? And just do it. Stick to it.
That's so true, man. It's so true. And it's the old saying that I would have, you know, it's no good to say, well, when I become a pro, then I'll eat right. Then I'll sleep right. I mean, I'll do all those things. I just need to be a pro first. No, it's do all of the things that it takes to be a pro. And then you might stand some sort of a chance to be a pro. I think it's the same thing for kids in high school. Even if they can't graduate early, if you can take that high school senior year and imagine, okay, I'm in college now, and this is what I'm going to do, and this is the lifestyle that I'm going to live, start doing it before you get there. It will give you a little bit of a leg up.
Yeah, I say the phrase, speak it into existence. I mean, if you want to be a pro, you got to speak it and you got to do it. You have to come up with a plan. You got a weekly plan, daily plan. When are you getting your extra 1,000 touches? Your finisher. When are you getting the extra shots that, you know, I'm guilty of this as a coach. We don't spend 30 minutes of practice working on finishing for the forward. So we might go a couple of days in a row. We don't actually work out. We do stuff to goals, but that's not working on your finishing technique. So you got to build that into your daily plans and around the intensity of the session. You got to speak into existence. You're planned to, Usain Bolt has a great quote. He's like, I spend 4 years working for like 9 seconds or whatever, however fast he ran.
Right.
It's like, but everyone thinks that I'm just fast. No, I spent 4 years working for 9 seconds and making millions of dollars. Right. So it's like, you want to be a pro, you want to be in college. Like, you might be the best player in your youth team or high school team. That's not going to matter once you get to the next level. It's what can you do at the next level? Just like you said, when you go play pro, instead of being 20 years old, you're going against 35-year-old men. We're fighting for contracts and trying to stay a pro or whatever it may be. And so it becomes much and much more ruthless and competitive to, and I say this to our guys, like, the hardest part is not getting your first contract. You can fool anybody that you're a good player. You put up a lot of stats.
Getting the second one.
It's the second one. It's the second one because your body of work on the first one will get you a second one. And now you're a 2-year pro. Hey, I'll take this guy on my team because he has experience. Same thing with the transfer portal. Go somewhere and be successful. Then you get a second contract or a second opportunity, and that's how you make it. And I think everybody gets that backwards, despite us coaches trying to advise people to go somewhere where you're wanted. Never say no, or don't brush off, or don't not respond to Joe Schmo's school that you don't respect, because they might be the last one standing, or they might be, hey, we still need you. We still need that left back, and you're the last one standing. And then I'm going to be like, no, I don't like the way you handled your communication with me. So I would have, but you weren't interested the first time.
Yeah, well, the very first podcast we ever did was with Bobby Clark, and I'm listening to that, and he said, the most important advice that I'll ever give a player is to go where you're wanted. And I had never thought about it, Chris, not really. I hadn't. And since that moment, it's the number one piece of advice that I give players. I think about, the old saying that, when God closes a door, he opens a window, that kind of thing. I think, but when that door closes, you can also defy him and kick that door open. But don't be surprised if there's a monster ready to kill you on the other side of the door. In other words, maybe you shouldn't be kicking down doors that didn't open for you. And we see players do this and they quickly transfer out. I mean, I had a kid one time, he was a junior college All-American, and he was determined he was going to play D1 no matter what. And he had 3 or 4 offers on the table, and all were very competitive schools that could play. And he took the Division I offer. It was about a week and a half into training. He says, I'm never going to play here. I'm not the level that these players are. And he ended up transferring mid-season into an NAIA school that he could get into, and had a wonderful career, was captain of the team, one of the leaders, led them into the tournament that he never would have gotten at that Division I school. But he was darn determined to kick that door open, even though it wasn't the best door for him to walk through. And it's I think sometimes we as people just have to learn that lesson for ourselves. Nobody's going to tell us. We have to learn it for ourselves. Then other kids will listen to the advice and can see the big picture. But it's hard, isn't it?
Sure. And I always tell, like, when I speak at like our D-camps and recruiting seminars and stuff, I go, look, don't think your teammates are committing here, there, and everywhere, junior years, early senior year. It's irrelevant. It's 100% irrelevant. You are the one living your experience, not theirs. Yeah, you'd be happy for them or be disappointed for them. I don't care what you feel. you are the one living the experience. Maybe your mom or dad really wants you to go to school A, B, and C, but you hate it because it's in the middle of nowhere, or it's in a city, or it's their alma mater. I know that that may be what their dream is. It's your life. I'm very sensitive about our student athletes' college career. I love college athletics. I love the time I had as a student athlete for my 4 years, and I'm very sensitive about my players being where they're wanted. I don't typically recruit guys that will never play here, and I don't recruit guys that will only be playing in their junior, senior. I want guys who play early and often, and if I can't get that, or maybe I didn't get it right, or the level's too high for you, like you mentioned with that other player, I'm going to help you, and I'm going to make sure that we get at least the last 2 years right. And I'm very adamant and passionate about your time, because you know, we'll be going back to the transformational and transactional is like, you're not going to go talk about, you know, how awesome the soccer cleats were 20 years from now. You're not going to talk about right. zip up jacket that you had. Right. You're going to talk about the memories, the friendships, the bus rides, yeah. the road trips, the game winning goals, like the culture, the brotherhood, sisterhood. So that's why for me, it's my culture is everything. And I believe so much in bringing people in that are here for all the amazing things we can offer you. But if you're here because we have nice gear, it's probably not a good reason for me to recruit you, because that stuff wears off after you wear it 50 times, you know, like it's not that cool anymore. Okay. We all want nice stuff, but the new car smell wears off. Right. And so that's why everything else has to be override. That's why I'm kind of like an under promise over deliver type coach in person, is that I want you to come here, not because our stadium's amazing and our campus is beautiful. I want you to come here because of what we can do for you and uplift you in your career. And so I think that's so important to going where you're wanted, and, coaches who invest in you. And I think the other thing is, when we went back to the why, is like, I also didn't want to go somewhere where I was going to sit for 2 years. I played almost every minute on every team I ever played on. And not that I wanted it easy. I always actually went up age groups and played for teams because I wanted to scrap and claw and absolutely get pushed. That was me. But I also didn't want to go somewhere where I was not going to play. I'm a passionate player and I wanted to play. And so you got to find that level. What makes you happy? And if it's too easy, I probably would have transferred, but it was a good level for me. And I competed and I started for 4 years, but I had to earn it. I had to work for it. And that's was what I want. I wouldn't want to have gone somewhere and sat for 2 or 3 years, because not that I wouldn't have worked for it, but I wanted to play. Right. And that's, some guys just want to go to their dream school and sit for 3 years and maybe play their senior. That's okay too. Whatever is your why is okay. You know, it's your living, your experience, not anyone else's. Don't compare, you know, comparison is the thief of the joy. Right. And so you can't compare to anyone else. Just worry about your life and your success.
No, that's right. And as you were talking there, two stories came to mind. You know, my son, all he wanted to do was soccer. It's all he ever talked about from the time he was 10. That was it. And he went to a school at St. Francis in Loretto, Pennsylvania, which is, it's the definition. If you look in the dictionary, the middle of nowhere, it would be Loretto, Pennsylvania. It's Amish country. I think the town is 750 people when school's not in session. And he went to play for Coach BJ Craig, who of course is, you know, went on to Notre Dame and Oregon and now at UNLV. But he didn't care about the town. He didn't care about the weather. He wanted to play for a coach who believed in him and would give him an opportunity to prove himself so he could see, could I be a pro at the end of the day? That's all he cared about. And so again, your individual why is just what's so important to know. Shakespeare said, know thyself. And that's such a, in two words, that's the one of the deepest statements that I've ever really contemplated. If you can truly know your whys, not your parents' why, not your friend's why or your grandma's why or what anybody else wants for you, but why am I doing this? I think you've got such a better chance at finding your right fit. And there's people that make fun of me online for talking about the right fit. Oh, you're never going to know what the right fit is until after you're actually at the school. And okay, there's some of that. But if you're driven to make that decision, and we call it a series of check boxes, Chris, right? But the problem is the check boxes not only are not weighted equally, the academics, the location, the weather, you know, that the quality of the team, whether they win or lose or what conference they're in, not only are they not weighted the same, but they're not weighted the same for you as they're weighted for me. Each of us has our own. I mean, if a kid truly cannot play in cold weather, and hates cold weather and hates living in cold weather, then Syracuse is probably a terrible choice. In fact, it might be the worst choice they could make in the entire nation. As wonderful as Syracuse is, it's not known for its great winter weather. And for 4 to 5 months of the year, you won't be able to play outside even if you wanted to, no matter how many shovels you have. It's just, it's too much. However, if somebody can't stand the humidity, then maybe Florida's a bad place or Houston's a bad place, right? And if you know, if but for some people, that's not important to them. They don't care if it's Alaska. If it was Alaska University and that was their chance to make it professionally, they would go to Alaska University. They don't care where it's at. So knowing what's important to you and what's not important to you, and then I encourage people to take those tick boxes that are important to you and to weight them. Weight them. This is, you know, soccer is a 10 out of 10, or academics is a 10 out of 10, and soccer is an 8 out of 10. It doesn't mean that the soccer coach doesn't care about you because soccer is an 8 out of 10 instead of 10 out of 10. It means you're being honest with yourself, and you're going to make a better decision to find the right fit based on that. Do you go through this type of exercise with your recruits to make sure you're getting the right recruit, or at least plant seeds in their head, like almost talking some kids out of coming to you because you want to know that they're going to be loyal to you and they're going to stay at the school, right?
Yeah, for sure. You gotta do. And this is an investment. I use the old business model. It's like you want to retain your customers because it costs more to go and find new ones, right? And so
yes,
you got to do your homework to get the right person who, you know, isn't after 6 months going to fail out, or like, coach, I'm going to come to you and score goals and leave. Oh, okay. That's what you want to do. Then I'm not probably going to bring you in originally because it's not what I'm here for. Now, if you come in and you crush it and I want to help you go somewhere else, I'm happy to do so. But that wasn't your intentions off the get-go. Yeah, I think you're so right about that. You know, when I use my experiences, I always thought, I won't mention the school, like I was going to go to this school, not too terribly far from where I grew up, but it was massive school and it had big facilities and big sports and everything. And I got there, I was like looking around, I'm like, actually, this is what I don't want. I don't want to get a bus across campus. I don't want to sit in a 300 person classroom. So I always say, like, sometimes you'll actually find out what you don't want before you find out what you do want. And then I realized, wow, go visit these places and go, when you're driving to a soccer tournament and this school's on an exit, just drive around the campus and maybe you'll realize, wow, I thought that school was a junkie. It's awesome. Or vice versa. This school I thought was gonna be great. We visited, it's in the middle of a bad neighborhood. I don't want to be anywhere near this. So you kind of learn by just little stops along the way, little planned visits. You can never start too early on that stuff. And then I always say tell anybody, go get ESPN Plus for 2 or 3 months, watch as many college games as you can in the fall. It's not that expensive. Yep. And you'll watch, maybe you're going to want to go watch Clemson because they're probably one of the best teams in the country, but watch who they're playing against too. You might say, wow, I had no idea X, Y, and Z school was good, or wow, it's only an hour from my house. I didn't even hear about them. You'll always find that style of coaching, that style of play fits you. Wow. I got to consider, oh, they have economics. That's high. Excellent. Perfect. Okay. So when you vet out everyone's details and motivation, I can tell in the recruiting process, can I spend more energy on this guy? Cause he talks the talk. He knows Lindenwood. He knows what we're good at. He knows what our record is. He's not just, oh, who are you, coach? And then I ask on a phone call, hey, you know anything about us? No.
You're not that nothing worse than that, Chris. Nothing worse than somebody asking questions that are posted online in your profile about you, and the kids asking you questions like, oh, you really don't care that much about us, do you?
Yeah. And if I have to do all the talking and I have to do all the selling, then this isn't a two-way street here. And I'll go more than my share because I'm trying to influence you about us and me and what we're doing. But there has to be an interest level that you're hopping on a call with a college coaches, whether it's the highest coach, me, or one of my assistants. Time is money and money is time for both of us, right? So it's always important that I have players in conversation that are invested. You don't have to know everything about us, but you look up our record, look at what we've done or what I've done or my assistants and where we've been and who we played and who we beat and what degrees. And then that's all free. It's on the internet. Go search for 10 minutes and you can find something. So that investment level in them is important for me. And then vetting out the questions of what drives them. Well, coach, I really want to get a $20,000 scholarship, this, that, and the other. Well, what happens if I only have 18? That school has it 20. So you're going to make a choice between two completely different schools over $2,000. That $2,000 would be like me giving you a dollar and you never repaying me over the course of time. You can't pay back your college soccer experience, but you can pay back money. So it's not like I gave you $100,000, you didn't pay me back. That's going to hurt me and my family, but
right.
You know, $2,000 in the grand scheme of thing is not that big. Don't make a choice based on money. And when I start hearing kids talk about that, or like you said before, like how much scholarship am I going to get, how much NIL, you're already talking about all things I don't really want to be talking about until I realize, are you even a good fit here? You're clearly not. Right. You're all invested in all the stuff I don't want to talk about off the bat. To quietly, quickly say is like, I do appreciate sometimes those conversations because right off the bat, the dad or the kid will be like, hey, I need a full rider. I can't go there because just money's tight. okay, you actually saved us a lot of time and I don't have a full ride for you. I'm sorry. Right. So I think doing all that vetting is really important at times, but just how you do it. But ESPN Plus is wonderful. And then they can know, hey, I watched your game against so-and-so and I really liked your style of play and da da da.
And by the way, to everybody out there listening, if you're talking to maybe a Division II school or an NAI school, something that's not on ESPN Plus, ask the coach to send you 3 or 4 typical games from their season. I've never met a coach who said, no, I don't want to share that with you. Never. In fact, if you ask that, kids out there, that coach may want to recruit you 10 times as much just because you asked that question, because most kids won't ask that question. And I do think it's important to every single school that you say you're interested in or that you're talking with the coaches with, that you watch 3 to 4 games of their season. I think it's really important.
Imagine
I don't think most kids are doing it, Chris.
Yeah, and imagine if I send 3 or 4 games and not a long period of time goes by and you then respond back to me, hey, I really like the way you played in this game. I like how you tactically changed in this one. Oh, you were unlucky in this one because that happened in the 75th minute. Like, holy smokes, this guy in 2 days watched 4 of my games and knew everything about us. And I like that tactical change. That is investment in us. And it took time out of your day, but you're totally right. Like that's the type of stuff versus just parents saying, hey, just when you write the email, the first paragraph, write 3 sentences about the school and then go back to your shtick. You know what I mean? It's better to do that than not do it. Don't get me wrong. But I also get like 1,000 of these emails a day and I just kind of can't get through all of them, you know, just impossible.
And you can tell in the first paragraph. So the first 30 seconds, I know if the kid is sending that same email and just changing a paragraph and sending it to every school in the country. In fact, the best ones, Chris, are when they forget to take off the BCC. And they literally send it to every school in the country.
Yeah, dear Coach Johnson. No, actually, I'm Coach Burt, so you got that wrong.
But I can introduce you to Coach Johnson. I know him is always my response. Would you like me to introduce you? Because I don't want you here if that's how you're going to fish, right?
Yeah, or all the fonts are different and like, dear so-and-so, and then the next paragraph's different. It's like, I know you're cutting and pasting. Look, we've all made mistakes on emails here and there before, but really, if you really want to play college soccer, it has to become a part-time job. As much as you like to go and hang out with your friends, it has to be that important. If you really want to go to your dream school or schools, you need to spend an ample amount of time, not just on a Friday night sending emails once in 6 months. You got to do it all the time. You got to make that plan. You got to check the emails. You got to watch games. You got to follow up, comment on the email. Hey, great job on the weekend. Great win, coach. I'm looking forward to watching the next game. You got to keep being studious about that. Yeah. And you got to be detailed. You got to check your spelling. You got to check how you're sending things and how you're saying, coach, I like you. I don't like the way you're talking to me. Like, delete.
Yeah, you know, we do this for a living and introducing kids to college coaches. And I tell parents, you really don't need us. And the kids, you don't need us. But you do have to be prepared, as you said, to spend the next 2,000 hours getting this done. It is not just going to happen because you send out a bunch of emails to every coach at the next tournament that you're going to go to and say, please come see me play at field 12 at 12 o'clock on Saturday. And then you're going to perform so well that every coach there wants to recruit you. It's not how it works, you know, or you can hire somebody to help you and you can save the hours. And this isn't an advertisement for Sports Recruiting USA, but the fact is that it is work. And it is, like you said, it's almost a full-time job getting it done if you're going to do it right. Right. I mean, you could just walk down the street to your local community college, knock on the door of the coach and said, when's your tryout? Can I have room on your roster? And can I play here? And you can be playing college soccer. And if you become an All-American, then, you know, Coach Birch at Lindenwood might be interested in you. Or, you know, it's a process though, Chris, right?
Sure. Like you said about being a pro, it's like, very few, the less than 1% probably have an easy time in the recruiting. Like that, you don't have to send an email out to anybody. Everyone's just going to, the second you become June 15th, your junior year, people are emailing you. But then it's difficult because then you got to sort through all the amazing clutter that you got. Otherwise, assuming you're in the 99%, that the recruiting process is hard or you have to vet out a lot of things and you got to do deep dives. And yes, the coach likes you. Yeah, and he wants you to bring you in. I want to go to that school. But he offered me $15,000 less than I expected. Oh boy, do I go to my dream school? Do I say no because I want that $15,000 more or whatever. So it's like you said, with the check boxes, it's like the puzzle is so massive and you're never going to get everything right. What are you willing to give up to get what you want? You know, maybe you're going to get the soccer side, but the academics aren't good. Maybe the social scene stinks. You're in the middle of nowhere. And I didn't want to go to school in the middle of nowhere. I wanted to go to a school with things to do. I like going to museums and going to parks and stuff like that. I didn't want to be bored, right? So you have to, what are you willing to give up? And you got to find, what can I get the most of everything? What's cost affordable? And by the way, is the coach a good guy, a bad guy, him or her? And like, do we have a good relationship? Do they want me? Or am I just trying to force myself upon a good school? So it is really, really hard. But there's more information than ever out there. And there's more video. It's like, you know, when I played and you played, it was like, there wasn't a lot of stuff. And getting
no, VHS at best. Yeah,
it is so much easier now to get the information ahead of time. The hard part's sorting through it all, right? And so that's the hard part of it all. You know, I don't envy the processes now, because, you know, I'll get emails, hey, I'm going to the MLS next event out at the Coachella and all that. And it's like, well, have you ever been to that complex? It's like the world's biggest soccer complex. It's the fields are 9 miles apart, and you're on field 12 and your other team, I've got to watch on field 13. Guess what? They're at the two ends. They're not actually at the same spot. They're at the other end. So I can't watch both of you, and I missed you. And so it's just hard, because that's my chance to get you. And maybe I went over to see you and you didn't play. So I'm not going to sit around for a halftime, wait for you to get in. So it's like, sending an email once in a while ain't going to work. You got to maybe sometimes get in front of these coaches some other way. You have to get on their campus. You got to do an unofficial visit. You got to invest a little bit of your time and money if you really value trying to make it in your college experience. You got to do what the 99% have to do. Work harder to try and get yourself where you want to go. And trust me, it'll be well worth it if you're able to do the work in the front end to get what you want in the back end.
Dang. I think we sit here and we sifted through a lot here, and I think we ended up with some gold nuggets there at the end for the recruiting. And I really appreciate your time, Chris. We've been at it for an hour and a half, and it feels like it was only 30 minutes, but I really appreciate you coming on with us, man. I do. Do you have any camps coming up, by the way?
Yeah, we have one on February 8th. Just in a couple months. It's just birchsoccer.com, BERTSCH. soccer.com, and links to on our website as well.
Good. We'll make sure that we put that, everybody. That'll be in the notes for the episode. Well, we'll make sure that we list that. And so if somebody's going to have fallen in love with you today and decide they want to see if they can play at Lindenwood, this would be an opportunity to get in front of coach and at least to be coached to him. I always told my son, Chris, when we talked about ODP trials or trials for this team, and you know, the question would come up, is it worth it? I said, look, it's another day to play soccer, man. If you love soccer, then go get coached by somebody else. Go learn something new today. So people talk about sometimes about camps, like if I don't get picked up, it was a waste of time. It's only a waste of time if you look at it as there's only one way to win, and there's only one thing I can pull out of this, and that's to be recruited. And I think maybe that's a little short-sighted. I think this is a good opportunity for something else to learn.
100%. I mean, I always find players at our ID camps. Like half my rosters are typically from ID camps. But let's say you get 40, 50 kids. Like, well, I can't be adding 15 kids from a camp to my roster. It's just like the percentages. It's just one or two kids might make it. Maybe next camp it's not. And the next camp there's two more. And so, it's hard. You got to invest. And I know everyone's not made of money to go fly around the country and drive around the country and go spend an exorbitant amount of money to go to camps. But do your homework. Can you really, like, there's some really awesome camps out there. Can you really play at that school? Is that a pipe dream? Or you just think it's cool and you want to go see their facilities? That's fine. But understand, these top elite schools are searching the world for top talent. So
literally,
the best way I would say for the ID camps is go at a reasonable school where you think you can play and make it, not because you want to be the 30th best player on the roster, because that's probably not going to be why they're going to recruit you. They're only going to recruit you if you can impact the roster. So dumb down a little bit your list and go to the ones that you have true aspirations of potentially playing at. And then I think from there, you'll realize if I didn't even get recruited at that one, then lower your standards a little bit and then find the ones at the sweet spot with your academics, your soccer, and your social. If you can get those three things right in the school, that's a pretty good school to try and match up what you're looking for.
I love it. Thanks, Chris, again, for coming on. That's fantastic advice. And you and I will be talking soon about players, I'm sure.
Awesome. I appreciate it. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, brother. Thanks.